So I'm afraid all I managed to do was get to a vegan flapjack.
That's very good.
Isn't that great?
That's even better.
Whereas what we have, and you have first choice, is a couple of cupcakes.
Oh my word.
Hello and welcome to this special Halloween episode of the Beyond Shakespeare podcast. Woo. Okay, that's a lie. Yes, we've a tenuous connection to the supernatural as we're talking about Dr. Faustus, but it's just a coincidence of scheduling. I'm your host, Robert Crichton, General Overseer of the Beyond Shakespeare podcast, which specialises in creating full-cast audio adaptations of drama from before 1642, with the exception of Shakespeare, as well as providing background and other production resources. You can support our work and get a say into what we produce by becoming a patron today. Go to www.patreon.com/beyondshakespeare. Today I'm talking with...
I'm Ricky Dukes, the Artistic Director of Lazarus Theatre Company.
And I'm Gavin Harrington Adidra, I'm Creative Producer of Lazarus Theatre Company.
About their upcoming work on Dr. Faustus, as well as their past productions of other plays by Christopher Marlowe, including Edward II, Dido, Queen of Carthage, and Tamburlaine the Great, so great he got two parts. Lazarus is an award-winning theatre company reimagining and revitalising classic work in visual, visceral, and vibrant productions. Lazarus is currently in residence at the Greenwich Theatre, and their latest season begins in February next year. But at the moment, they're doing some work on Dr. Faustus, and that's why I was invited up to the Greenwich Theatre to chat and eat cake with Ricky and Gavin.
That looks like a bit of a red velvety one,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, so whichever you...
I think I'll go with this. Are we doing this while we're podcasting?
Oh, I think there's no reason why...
Christopher Marlowe was born in 1564 and he died somewhat bloodily in 1593. Didn't live desperately long, but he whacked out 7 rather good plays. Lazarus has done quite a few Marlowes, and in fact quite a few early modern plays. So they've got experience in the practicality of making early modern plays come to life, as well as the practicalities of trying to find audiences. And later in the podcast, we'll be discussing those practical difficulties, the differences between working in a studio space to actually putting on a play in a space which is quite large. The realities of what you choose to put on in a space where you need to fill 400 seats. But for the moment, we're talking about Dr. Faustus, who sells his soul to Mephistopheles for a quota of years in return for magical powers and all sorts of exciting adventures. In the end, he gets, spoiler alert, ripped to shreds and dragged down to hell. We'll be looking at the plays of Christopher Marlowe in more detail in future podcasts coming next year. But first, we'll talk about Dr. Faustus. And the first voice you'll hear will be Ricky Dukes.
So it's more of a collaboration that we're doing with Bath Spa University. So it's not playing as part of our residency at the Greenwich, at the moment anyway. So it's a group of third year actors that I'm working with. We actually start next week rehearsing it. Christopher Marlowe's Dr. Faustus. So earlier this year and last year we did a production of Edward II. And we've done two Marlowe's before. So Tamburlaine and Dido, Queen of Carthage. And this is something about Marlowe that really excites me as a director. There's something about... the way, I think it's because he was a bit of a trendsetter, a bit of a, you know, in many ways, the first to go places that other writers have not done. And in a way, there's something, I guess, about the mystery of him as a writer. Also, he was murdered quite close to where we are here at the Greenwich Theatre. So there's a local interest as well. There's quite a lot of things he does as a writer. I guess, essentially, he's incredibly theatrical, which just ticks my boxes as a director. And I think the work that we do, which is very ensemble, very visual, so therefore it has an accessibility about it, because we think about how do we immerse the audience in the world of the play, what's the audience's experience, what do they feel when they leave, and we work in quite a Brechtian way, so we're not trying to tell the audience how they should feel, but we must feel something. So very often we get audiences that leave with complete wide-ranging maybe opinions about the show, but more about, I'm more interested in the subject of the show. So in the case of Edward II, you had people leaving, and we did it at the end, we did it with It Rained Blood on him. So it's quite a visual, dare I say, sort of European approach to it. For spoiler alert, there's a big poker involved, if anyone doesn't know that. There we are.
And yes, Edward II does not end well.
No, but incredibly theatrically in our production. And the responses ranged from people sat horrified for about 30 minutes afterwards, which is great, because people have had that very Elizabethan, early modern, what I call guttural experience. It feels like you've been punched in the gut, which I think is really exciting. Two others who were just taking selfies of themselves with the bloodstained set, pouting, which I thought was sort of incredible, really. So I think Marlowe sort of does something to us that, and maybe because he's not as famous as, are we allowed to say, Mr. Shakespeare?
You can. There is a quota.
But I think the great thing that about Marlowe is there's a little bit possibly less baggage that comes with him because perhaps he's not as famous. So in some ways, it feels that you can play a little bit more with the play, with the edit, with the ideas, which is exciting. So Faustus felt to me a bit of a natural journey, really. And it's definitely a play that is very Lazarus, it's very ensemble-minded, even though, of course, it's focusing on Faustus. But Marlowe's playing with this whole theatrical meta, really, of the appearances, disappearances, and a bit of spectacle, which you just think is really relishing, particularly for young actors to get into, who might not have approached this text before. There's something really incredibly visceral about it. You know, how are they going to play the seven deadly sins and the devil appears and then Lucifer appears? You sort of think, this is incredible. This is really exciting. And the group of actors I've got are well up for it. You know, they've done with their naturalism. They're ready to explore the theatrics and how you could take an audience on that theatrical experience. So how do we make this theatre feel like there's actually a conjuring of the devil? Do we want to make them feel, as an audience member, you're part of this experience, rather than that you're just observing an experience? So there's something I think about Marlowe that jumps off the stage a bit and makes us participate in a way that other writers perhaps don't. So, yeah, really excited about getting involved in Faustus. And it's, as I say, it's a play that I've known for a while and wanted to do for a while, and it might be something that we do as part of our residency here at the Greenwich. But for now, it's a chance to experiment and play with the students of Bath Spa, which it then plays at the end of November in their big studio theatre up on main campus, which is quite exciting because it's got all this technical wizardry, which I totally think Marlowe would be completely utilising if he could. Loves a good trick, good love spectacle. So we're going to go for it.
Which text or text? Because we have an A and a B text, ladies and gentlemen. There are two slightly different versions.
Well, I guess because it's a third-year drama, well, they're acting students, actually, a degree, the brief really is to cut it down, so quite a good edit. So we're going to go with a 90-minute version. So the easiest thing with Faustus was to remove all of the comedy, inverted commas, scenes. So we've done that, and actually that was a very easy edit because you really do, in one swoop, you get rid of quite a lot of difficulties. And, you know, thinking about early modern plays, part of me used to feel that their themes are universal and therefore they felt very contemporary. But actually, remembering the play was written for an audience, you know, 500 years ago, it's not necessarily what our audience is going to be that interested in now. So that's quite quick, actually, and that's quite an easy thing to do. So text-wise, it's more based on the A text.
Which is the shorter.
Shorter version.
Yeah. Less sort of middle padding, I think. It's fewer chicken wings thrown at the phone, is how I've always thought of it.
I guess it's when, as theatre makers, you go into it thinking, what does our audience right now want to get from it? Or what do we think they want? Because you never really know. And also, what's exciting for a group of contemporary players? What's going to speak most immediately to them? So I do think sometimes the comedy gets a bit lost because it doesn't really equate to us. So there's a version where you think, well, maybe we rewrite that. But in this case, it's a case of actually it's quite an easy edit to make. You know, sometimes we get a bit of a telling off for cutting, particularly when it's someone's favourite speech. And you can only apologise, but, you know,
or shrug.
Or shrug or ignore it. I mean, I tend to, again, maybe I'm getting old and a bit more mellow, I tend to then try and explain why it went, if I can remember, because sometimes you decide these months. And sometimes the answer is just because it's not very good. But actually, what do you really mean by it's not very good? We don't respond to it. It doesn't touch us. You know, so sometimes it's less of the pruning knife. It is a bit more of a machete you have to take to it. But it's about our audience. I think that's the big thing, is what's the audience in the room at the time responding to? And fashions, of course, coming in out. Again, I wonder whether that's something about tragedy, that in some ways, those themes are a bit more universal and a little bit more timeless, perhaps, than the comedy, particularly the comedy that's quite specifically talking about you know, for example, in Faust, you've got the horse drive, haven't you? And you sort of think, well, actually, you could totally contemporise that as some used car salesman or something. But what do we get from that? Do we get anything from it? Do we not? Is it a conveniently comic piece just before the tragedy? So we actually, is there a kind of antithesis to that? So we try and work out the almost the dramaturgy of what's the point of it, really.
In terms of with Faustus, obviously, you've got the religious dimension.
He's throwing some pretty big questions, like massive, actually. Mm. Huge questions in the air. I'm a big fan of a Brechtian process where you don't necessarily have to come up with all the answers.
No.
You're presenting the question. And that's certainly not a cop-out. You know, I've been accused, well, that's such a cop-out. Well, no, I'm not here to tell you as an audience what to think. I'm not going to give you the answer. We're raising the questions and then saying, here's some tools to go and find out, or change the world you live in, or, you know, is Faustus a complete, arrogant, ignorant idiot who has everything coming, or an innocent victim who's caught up in greed? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And would your choices, if you've made that bargain, would you do more interesting things? What would you actually do with the power of Satan? So that's one of those things, is everyone's sort of saying, well, he doesn't really do very much. And I'm sort of thinking, think about it. What would you actually do?
Yes.
And actually, if I'm honest with myself, they're not exactly high up or exultant things. My personal thing, I think I'd definitely like to go back and record episode 4 of The Tenth Planet, Power of the Daleks, and a few other odds and ends. But
so, yes, world peace doesn't come straight to mind.
Sort of that.
Yeah.
Well, how do you even define it?
Yeah,
I like, one of my favourite bits in Faustus is when the old man towards the end is sort of trying to talk him round, and Mephistopheles says, "Well, I can't touch him. He's too good." And I was saying, so what can he do? What can he throw? So he sort of sent the old man a limp. That was as much as he could do. He was just saying that. That's all I can do. He's too good. And it's always the serious bits where you suddenly find the sort of weird, whereas comedy, sometimes they're just trying a bit too hard.
Yeah, absolutely. And by looking for the light, you also find the tragedy. So I think there's something about the antithesis of the play, i.e. it's an incredibly serious scene. Well, actually, if you look for the light in it, the play will naturally settle into when it really is dark.
Mm.
You know, I mean, I do know of productions where the devil's coming on at the end, ripping apart, is a comedic scene. Mm. I can't quite imagine that in my head. It's violent and vile and horrible. But who knows? There could be something send up about that.
There's a clip on YouTube. There are mini clips on YouTube. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've had a troll. There's a student production which I can't decide whether it's genius or not. But the angel and the demon are done as sort of Muppet style puppets either side of his head, and I can't decide if it's brilliant or terrible, because it's sort of compelling. It's awful and it's compelling at the same time.
Which, funnily enough, is my no. It's not my idea.
But they weren't literally Muppet style. Fantastic. And sort of Muppet voices, and I'm sort of going, yes.
Yeah.
It got a reaction. It was visceral.
It got a reaction.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Nervous laughter from the audience. I don't think the audience quite knew what to make of it either.
So, yes, we're working in collaboration with Bath Spa University, with Dr. Faustus. That's the last week of November. If you Google Bath Spa University, all the details will be on there. And then our second season at the Greenwich Theatre starts in February with Mr. Shakespeare's Tempest. And then we're bringing back our production of William Golding's Lord of the Flies. And then we end with Oscar Wilde's Salome.
And I'll be rejoining Ricky and Gavin in a moment. And links to buy tickets to see Dr. Faustus at the end of November. If you live in the Bath area, do go buy tickets to see Dr. Faustus, or have a look at Lazarus at the Greenwich Theatre in the upcoming season. And I'll be rejoining Ricky and Gavin in a moment. I should mention that you can support the Beyond Shakespeare podcast on Patreon, patreon.com/beyondshakespeare. If you want to hear full cast audio adaptations of early English, early modern drama, then by just giving a $1 a month, or for my UK listeners, that's currently somewhere in the region of 70 to 80p, though exchange rates vary. You get early access to new audio, tickets to live shows, and more. More importantly, depending on what you give, you get voting rights to choose our next season for us. The next poll opens in December to decide our summer season, so get pledging and help decide what we do next. Coming soon on the podcast, we're just finishing our complete plays of John Heywood box set. John Heywood was a Tudor playwright, writing plays, the plays we're working on from the late 1520s to early 1530s. We're five plays down and just two to go. A Play of Love, which is a play about love, and The Play of the Weather, which is a play about the weather. It's a little more complicated than that. Anyway, these two plays will be out at the end of November, and so for the first time you will be able to sit down and listen to every single play that survives by John Heywood in one sitting, if you so wish, or in little snatches. It's entirely up to you. You can do whatever you like with them. They're podcasts. But now for some more discussion with
Ricky Dukes
and
Gavin Harrington Adidra,
generally talking about their work with Lazarus Theatre Company, and mostly talking about Christopher Marlowe and his other plays. It does, however, get a little bit more general.
So going back to some of your past Marlowe productions, so you've done Edward II relatively recently.
Yeah.
So how did you approach that one? In terms of, obviously, you've got three that you've previously done,
yeah.
And did you approach each of those differently, or?
I think so. So Dido was the first one, which we actually coincidentally staged at the Greenwich Theatre, although we weren't resident then, so that's back in 2013. And someone, open brackets me, close brackets, thought it'd be a good idea to do that in rep with King Lear. So there were two quite big plays with 3 weeks rehearsal and one company of actors doing both. But there was something quite rewarding, I mean exhausting, but quite rewarding about doing those two plays next to each other. And our King Lear was played by a female actor, so we were playing with this idea of these two quite powerful queens and their journeys, I guess. And in a way, I suppose Dido was far more ethereal and theatrical. I remember one review talking very much about John Dexter and his sort of directing style. And at the time, I knew who John Dexter was, but it wasn't a conscious sort of nod to how he would do it. But there was something quite inherently theatrical. You're playing with the gods and the ridiculous nature of the gods. So actually, we didn't really go down a contemporization. You know, the recent production at the RSC, sort of contemporary explanations for some of the gods, you know, whether they're taking drugs or of that. Whereas I guess ours was a little bit more ambiguous, perhaps. So that was a way in there. I mean, there were some edits, but actually most of the play remained.
I'm trying to remember how long Dido is. I don't think it's an epically long.
No, it's not huge.
It's about 2 hours or something.
Yeah, which for us with an interval that was fine. We could do that. And you do, and we often sit, you know, with our dramaturg Sarah, we sit and talk about what does the audience need to get out of it, and what's holding that up. And we do have to acknowledge, as contemporary storytellers, we're performing this for a contemporary audience, and that there will be some people in the audience who do want to see the full 3.5 hours, lock yourself in, get your flask ready, versions. And I think that's great, but our experience that our audience doesn't quite go for that, particularly when you're working on the fringe in London, where some of the seats are really uncomfortable, and you know the facilities might not be as lavish as some of the bigger houses. At the Greenwich, that's different because we do have the facilities for that. But also, it's about getting to the nitty gritty of the story. Sometimes, what's the bit that excites us? What is it about the play specifically that gets us going? And ultimately, for me, that's, you know, Brechtian style is the major events. And then moving to Tamburlaine, which is far more epic in scope. And
did you condense? Did you just do the first play, or did you condense?
We did both plays. Yeah. So part one was act one, then interval, and part two heavily edited, and part two was act two.
So many set pieces, I feel, with Tamburlaine.
Yeah,
well, we a series of set pieces.
Yeah, I think we called it something like the Carousel of Death at one point. Well, didn't we?
Carousel of Death, Carousel of Kings. It was because constant kind of revolving cultures and kings and death.
But there is an element, you go, oh, another one? You know, the way that Sir Gavin directed that, and this is part of the Camden Fringe that we performed at the Tristan Bates Theatre in Covent Garden, so a fairly small studio theatre. which is great because you then get the intensity of what's going on. You're there, you really are there, you're part of it. And that was part of the design, actually, wasn't it, that they came out of one door, yeah, a little bit like a Swiss clock, you know, and around on a conveyor belt and out the other way. So you sort of got this sense of this spiral continues and continues, and just another person to come up against Tamburlaine, effectively. Which in a way, did have a comic effect. You know, another one coming out through the door, you go, oh my God, what? You know?
But there is that balancing line of where does the comedy live?
My instinct is always to just go for it.
Yeah.
Just hit it on the head and just go for it. But of course, then there are consequences to that, and inevitably there's going to be things that offend people.
Yeah.
And I guess really, I think the more we've done, and this, maybe it's just me getting older, the more sensitive I am to that. There used to be a point where I'd go, oh, bugger it, that's what's happening, and that's the play. And actually, I think over time, maybe go, oh, actually, that is something to consider. And I think that's just as a company we've developed, and that's happened across the board, you know, in many departments of, you know, creating work. It's not, you know, running a theatre company, the play is the thing, but it's one of many things, yeah, and about what we're committed to and such like.
Maybe. Can't always know what's going to offend people as well. Like,
yeah,
I really thought in Tamburlaine that burning the Quran, and yeah, we literally had him throwing it on the floor in a pile of books. No one batted an eyelid, and I thought that was, you know, going to come up against.
We had lots of conversations about that. Oh, do you cut it? How do you do it, yeah, sensitively? Well, how do you burn the Quran sensitively? You know, you think, yeah, I'm not sure how we do that.
And we did.
We had loads of conversations. How do you do this? And actually, you know, having seen the RSC's production recently, I think Michael Boyd had done something quite beautiful but epic in the way that they did it. Mm. But it's still throwing a book in a trap with some smoke. So it's interesting, isn't it, that we thought there was going to be repercussions, but actually maybe people just don't know.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that's part of it. People don't... Or are the audience coming to it? No, that's coming. So there is no shock factor because they're just waiting for that bit. So maybe actually it's about audiences and what we as audiences are capable of accepting. Mm. I'm not...
It's not a surprise.
No.
It's not like this audacious thing that's happening.
No, and actually part of our remit of being here at the Greenwich is we want to bring these plays to audiences that don't know what these plays are. Mm. That, you know, for me it feels there's not much point doing the plays anymore. What we have done in the past is played to, you know, in studio theatres where you just don't get... The play could reach for broader audiences and wider audiences, and actually it'd be great to get that genuine shock and surprise, people actually sitting there having no idea how this thing ends.
Mm.
I think that's something that certainly we talk to actors a lot about in rehearsal. Let's not play the end game, and let's make people think this really old play that they think they know what the play's about, actually maybe there's an alternative ending, maybe this isn't inevitable.
Mm.
And of course the definition of tragedy is there's an inevitable, someone's going to die, but at the same time, let's not play that inevitability. Let's see if there's a hope or there is going to be some way of getting out of this. It just keeps the audience a little bit more on the edge of their seat rather than, oh, we know in 3 hours' time such and such is going to die.
Yeah.
You know. But maybe that's it about surprise and the whole thing with the Quran. Maybe the audiences are just not then surprised, or they know about it or...
Or it doesn't have the meaning that it had then or it should have. Or
Do you find with early modern plays, the sort of weight of the popular culture at the time, which you're not getting the references to. How do you impart that knowledge?
Mm.
You know, do you just cut the line or adjust the line, or do you find a contemporary version? It's all those sort of games of the little bits of information that get caught in plays and that make them less accessible. Is so much.
It's so on the nose for the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you do a half an hour lecture before they start so they get the jokes?
Well, that programme note is very long. I think the answer to is all of those things in a way. Mm. So that we have had productions where you go, actually, that just isn't serving our audience, or we, you know, you can research till the cows come home. My feeling, just off the top of my head, is thinking that's more so with comedy than it is with tragedy, in that that's just not funny, and you're referencing something that might have been hilarious at the time. I think in an academic sense, when, you know, the great tragic characters talk about the gods, there might be something that ticks a box or turns a light on for contemporary audience still.
You know vaguely that there's a god.
Yes, absolutely. And by Jove, and all these sort of things, you think, oh, actually, there's a sense of scale. So in tragedy, sometimes that lends itself... You might not know the specific metaphor, but it lends to its big, the size of it. Whereas the comedy... We just don't have... We might just not be able to understand that. Well, and
it's also how comedy works as something that's about the patter.
Yeah.
The basic joke structure is fine. You understand what the gag is. But the patter's just not... You know, you're looking for the modern swing of the dialogue.
Yeah.
And it's not there.
Yeah.
And some are better than others. Every so often you just get a line that just leaps out at you, just going, that's so modern.
Yes. Yeah.
That's utterly, utterly today.
And that could be theme or as you say, timing.
Yeah.
It could be... There's So in a way, we try not to throw the baby out with the bathwater with that. But but there are things. You sit in a rehearsal room, you scratch your head for a while. Mm. And actually, I think in our experience, it's the first preview that tells you whether it works or not. Mm. But, you know, that group of first audience, it just falls flat and you think, oh no, there's nothing much to retrieve here. Well, there's a lot of work you can do to get to the preview. But, you know, a preview audience will tell you very quickly, I think. You know, it's interesting that a creative team member caught me earlier this year on a preview of a show, not watching the show, and it must have looked like I was sort of deeply bored. I was actually watching the audience, and you're sort of sitting there going, they're just not going for this, actually. There's got to be something else. And that can be frustrating sometimes for an actor, because you go, but I understand what it means. Mm. And you can say to them, I know you know that you know what it means, but there's something not communicating to them. There's something we're not quite doing yet. And it might be that it's just you can't communicate it. Maybe it's a joke, a gag, a line, a thought that doesn't communicate or respond to our audience. And actually, interestingly, in studio theatres, you could find the swing of one night to the other is massively different. You might have 50 people in totally get it and the next night don't. Whereas actually in a 400 seat where we are at Greenwich, it evens out.
Yes.
And you get a general consensus each time,
yes.
Which actually is fascinating and brilliant, because then you're building the show with everyone in mind rather than, well, last night got it but tonight didn't.
Yeah. So obviously I did write down a little list of all the early modern plays that you've done. You've mentioned Tamburlaine. Any additional thoughts on Tamburlaine in terms of the process of making that happen?
I think that was probably the most contemporary, spot on in many ways.
In terms of where we were placing it,
yeah,
I think so. I think, you know, it was a massive undertaking to do two plays in one evening. I think, it was the second Marlowe we'd done, so we'd done Dido before, and I was just struck by how different the writing style was. He very much writes for the style of play that he's writing, which I found quite fascinating and quite refreshing to know that this was the same writer as Dido, but a very different version of himself.
Yes, this idea that writers all write in one uniform way. And
well, indeed.
It's just going, well, they do write different characters.
Yeah,
and, you know, voices change.
And
people make that assumption.
And whether that's the style of the play, so, you know, whether he's writing in a different style because it's a different play, and whether that's conscious or not, or whether that's an evolution of a writer, you know, a maturity or a different interest or, you know, is interesting.
Or different actors. I mean, that's the other thing, is that if we think that Dido might have been for one of the boys' companies as opposed to, you know, the style of things, you know they can do that very well. And you know they can be big, loud men very well. Then you change your voice.
And the number of female characters in the two plays is very different as well.
Do you make conscious decisions in advance in terms of gender? Do you make adjustments, or
depends
is it saying a case by case basis?
Depends on the play. I mean, we as a company, we're trying, and it's quite hard when you're a classics company, but trying to get to 50-50 casting, and we're doing it quite a lot, and that has become a conscious commitment. But I think we'd be doing it anyway. It's just that now it's part of the, well, actually, how does that play fit that? There is one play coming up in our 2019 season where it's quite difficult to do. I mean, that's Salome, the Oscar Wilde play, to increase female roles in it. But certainly in early modern, and whether that be a female King Lear or, you know, whether you're changing the gender or whether you have a female actor play a male gender, we tend to change the gender, actually, and go, actually, let's not pretend Let's just actually change it. And then find all the incredible things that come out of that. So, you know, I think it's important that our stages represent our audience or the audience we want. So it's not good enough to say, I don't think, oh, well, our audience is this, so we'll just do that. Well, what do we want to develop our audience into? And we've got a number of initiatives here that try to get people who don't normally go to the theatre to come to the theatre. And that's an age thing, an economic thing. You know, there's a number of factors that prevent people, or people just don't think theatre's for them, or don't even consciously think of it. But actually, for us, it's about going, no, well, it can be. You just got to come through the front door and experience it. It's not scary, and it can be exciting. And this is where sometimes I go a little bit on a rant when you see a poor... Certainly Greek tragedy, that can turn people off for life if you see a bad Greek tragedy. I know people, it has, you know, an early modern, if it's not exciting or visceral and it's long and boring, it really turns people off. So that's not the sort of, I mean, there is an audience for those long versions, and, you know, whereas actually I think it's about, for us, is getting people into that action-packed version. So with Tamburlaine, it's this torrent of violence as well, the excitement of violence in Tamburlaine, people in the audience getting excited about violence, and you think, God, this writer's tapping into something really animalistic, or I don't want to say primeval, but, you know, there's something inside us that goes, I want to see some more violence. And this, you know, I say this to actors quite a lot, is why do we watch horror films or we go on roller coasters where we don't want to go on it and we scream? It's adrenaline rush. It puts us in touch with something that perhaps as contemporary people we're not in touch with as much. You know, so I think it's about making it exciting and visceral, really. And I think we used to be in a position in auditions where you go, let's just see what turns up. And there still is a little element of that, because rather than giving a casting director, oh, the actor must be this, 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 we keep it fairly quite broad still. Because I love that surprise when you go into a rehearsal room and actually an actor walks in and you go, I'd never thought of that. That's brilliant. Let's do that. An actor casts themselves, really. And it only happens occasionally, but when it happens, it's really exciting. So we still keep it broad. We saw Duchess of Malfi, didn't we, at the RSC fairly recently. And interesting that we came away... I mean, I loved it, actually, because I love that the later, real visceral... I mean, I love Webster, actually. I think it just really... Against the violence and the darkness, there's something really terrifyingly brilliant about it. But actually, the misogyny there, we talked about, and Sarah, our dramaturg, the three of us went, and we talked about, well, actually, if you regendered one of the roles, one of the brothers, perhaps, maybe that balances out some of the misogyny. And is that perhaps how you would do a contemporary production? And there's pros and cons to that, because part of me thinks, well, is that the point, that she is fighting this misogynistic world? And in a way, you can say, you could argue in 2018, maybe that's still happening, you know? So in a way, you then have to ask, well, is that the point? Is that what the writer's getting at? Or, and then it may well be, but then as a contemporary storyteller, are we okay with that, or do we need to change it or address it? And I think in a way, that's where my feeling always is, hit it head on. So if you're going to make it about misogyny, go for it. But you're pointing to an audience saying, this isn't right. Or if you're not going to go for it, don't. And then you regender. So actually, it I think what in the past had been a, well, that's an interesting experiment, has now become a far more conscious, okay, what's the repercussions, or what might be the opportunities? And of course, there might be some drawbacks, but actually for me, it's more about what does it gain us by doing that.
You did Tragedy of Miriam, just...
Yes, I did.
Tell me about, because it was voted by the patrons to do it. Although I did a rehearsed reading of it about 10 years ago. Now, I looked at the cast list. Did you sort of cut out the subplots?
We cut out subplots. We regendered a lot of roles. It was essentially a cast of 11. 10 of them were female, and then Herod was played by a man. Yes, we cut out subplots. It was part of the Camden Fringe, and it had to be an hour.
So we
had to make... It was an adaptation of... It was quite exciting to kind of look at how you take this play that's never been performed on a London stage and put it into an hour-long version. So, it did ask the question, is this really Tragedy of Miriam, or is it an adaptation? And I think we came down on the side that it's definitely an adaptation, but with you know, definite deference to the original closet drama. But yeah, we regendered, and it was really quite exciting to to work with it in the rehearsal room for 3 weeks and find out who these people were, and to hear it through a female's voice, you know, a female's writing, the focus on the female characters who are already in the play,
yes,
were, you know, were very
fair number.
Indeed, yeah. It wasn't too difficult to kind of have essentially an all-female cast but one. Yeah. I really, really love the character of Doris.
Yes. The only problem I have with Doris is her name is Doris.
I think that's everyone's problem with Doris.
Lovely name, Doris.
Well, we sort of deliberately stretched out the vowel so it was Doris. to just make it sound a little less like it might be someone in a tea shop.
I always thought Coronation Street character, you know, in a corner shop, yeah. A great thing to take, or I think the experiment, there's lots of reasons to do it, but the experiment for me was this play that is written to be read, or that there was something quite exciting about taking that and saying, actually, is this stageable? How do you stage it? And I suppose by default, then it's going to have to be an adaptation to a certain extent. Mm. I suppose it depends on what framework you use, but you're still using some sort of framework of how you perform that. So that was an interesting experiment, I think.
Definitely.
It was just something about how do you stage this thing, which we hadn't done before.
Mm.
So, you know, talking to directors who'd stage poems and things like that, actually, that was a little bit of an eye-opener. And whereas very often when you get, you know, say a Webster or something, there's something about that that's inherently theatrical.
Mm.
And here are the tricks. This is what you can see. This is what you got. And it's almost they're giving you this box of, you know, I often call it the Pandora's box of tricks. And you sort of go, brilliant. What's the tricks in this show then?
Mm.
And the writer sort of gives you all of these. And in a way, that didn't, in places, didn't necessarily leap off the page for Mariam. So you have to sort of investigate it in a different way. Which
yes, because you look at the text and you see big, long speech,
mm-hmm.
little exchange,
yeah.
big, long speech. And it's sort of, it's more like sort of aria and recitative.
Yeah,
And it's incredibly, it's all written in a very rigid rhyming structure as well. Mm-hmm. So to have that, to try and have that text natural on stage as well, is mm-hmm. it can be difficult.
Yeah.
You know, they try.
And there's a question. Should it be natural? Should it not be?
Well, where's the balance? Yeah.
Yeah. And I do, there is an element of, I mean, I'm not saying this is all actors, but quite a lot of actors that we work with, and they turn the page and here comes the big speech. There's a kind of gulp, you know, and I think it's, you know, actors who sing, they get to that big note and here we go, you know. There's a sense of trepidation sometimes. Mm. And of course, with Mariam, that was sort of every other page.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's, because we'll be doing these debate plays, which are very... Mm. I mean, the problem is, it's not even that it's a long speech. It's a long speech. There's only one full stop.
Oh, blimey.
And it's at the end. Everything else, it's a semicolon, if you're lucky. so you're eliding a thought to a thought to a thought to a thought to a thought. And it was interesting, because once the actors got into it, we did three or four of them, we got to another one, a later play, where he starts putting full stops in the set, and it's suddenly, oh, hang on. it's like they didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
It was like this structure's changed.
That's great. That's fascinating.
But that question... It's sort of easier with debate play because the other person is trying to step in.
Mm-hmm.
So I can effectively just sit there going, and okay, what's the first line, word of your next line? Find the point where you want to say it.
Yeah.
It becomes, and they get something to do.
Yeah.
Whereas if someone is emotively working their way through a scene, the other people kind of just have to take it, and it's what do you do? How do you make that function?
I wish I'd known that a long time ago. We did a production of Don Carlos, you know, the Schiller play,
yeah.
And that's got huge speech where no one speaks, then responds with a huge speech, and there's a lot of seemingly dead time where I'm just watching you, and that was quite a challenge, I think, for the actors to. Well, no, there can be active responses because the writer hasn't given you any text, so you can't say anything necessarily. But there's how do you keep that charge? That was a really difficult play to keep charged.
Mm.
You know, keeping that tension, that suspense, actually. We haven't done a Schiller since. Although Mary Stuart's totally on the list. But,
yeah, definitely.
I was going to say, are there any? You've done a lot of, shall we say, the non-Shakespeare canon.
Yeah.
Avengers tragedy, Spanish tragedy.
That's a goodie. Spanish is great.
I do like the Spanish tragedy. Any plays that you'd love to do in the future that you'd like to lobby for the audience to vote and
On our list of stage, The Changeling is at the top. I'd like to go back to do some Webster again, but we have already done The White Devil and The Duchess of Malfi, but that was a time ago, so maybe we could go back to them. But The Changeling, and it's interesting, we talk about the commercial element to it. The thing, where we are here at the Greenwich is, it's got absolutely brilliant opportunities, and the stage is, people who don't know the Greenwich, is quite a steep rake, so it feels very Greek amphitheatre. It wraps around the front of an apron of the stage, so it feels Elizabethan, but it's not very pretty. It's all very black brick exposed, so it feels quite Brechtian in its honesty. It's, in many ways, it lends itself to the early modern plays brilliantly. It's very democratic, it's open, but it has 400 seats. So when you're looking at plays, one of my favourite plays is Sejanus. There's no way that's going to happen here. And then even when you know, something like The Changeling, you think, I just don't think we'll be able to fill 400 seats on this for a 2 or 3 week run. So in many ways, there's a huge list at home in my office. I've got on the bottom shelf is the to-do list. And a lot of them have had to be taken off that and back up into the other shelves. And there for another time, you know, perhaps there's an opportunity of doing something like The Changeling, maybe in another venue, or something happens that, you know, whether there becomes a spark of interest in The Changeling all of a sudden, and we think, actually, this is the time.
I mean, in a sense, that's the point of my exercise, is to try and sell plays to audiences, to pre-sell, to actually gain some interest online to, this play exists, this play is great. More and more people listen to it in a nice, easy, accessible way. Maybe that will help make it commercial.
Yeah.
But my point is not to be commercial. My point is to lose lots and lots of money.
And it becomes a bit, you know, that's a bit of a balance for us as a company, because sometimes it becomes a labour of love. But what we have to do for the future of the company is, it can't be a very expensive hobby.
No.
So and you know, in the past, maybe some plays we've chosen because we love the play and we think it should have an outing. But without that being backed up funding-wise, you see, it's a very elaborate hobby, effectively. You know, it's a very lavish vanity project, it could be seen as. I hope that's not how our work is seen. So when we're now looking at this space and thinking, well, it's 400 seats, it's good. And it's one of those, because it's so democratic, i.e. you're aware that you're in an auditorium, because you're very often facing the audience as it wraps around the stage. Anything less than 50% capacity, it feels empty.
Yeah.
So we are having to really think about what early modern plays are really going to tick that box. Yeah. What interest is already out there, and what interest can be stimulated elsewhere to go, let's have a debate about this play, let's get this back on its feet. Yeah. Because really, that's the only way we can debate them, I think, is in performance, and whether that be audio or whether that be on stage, you know.
I'd really like us to see us do The Island Princess.
Yeah. Yeah, again, problematic in places.
Fletcher? Of course,
absolutely. And there are there's projects we have in mind that maybe might enable us to do those things. So thinking about how do we do either a rehearsed reading or a semi-staged production alongside a main house production? Are there ways of ensuring that we're keeping our hand in and the plays that we really want to explore next to something that might be, touch wood, a little bit more commercial?
Yeah.
So in a way, it's us thinking about, well, what are the plays that really spark an interest that don't get done very often?
Mm.
So then there's a, and I think that's where Edward ticked a box. And I think to a certain degree, all the Marlowes we've done, but again, they're in studios, so you're still capped capacity-wise.
Mm. How did Edward II, in terms of that transition, because it started
in the Tristan Bates Sierra studio, and we did it in Traverse, so it really sort of threw you in the midst of it, and it was a very contemporary production, but I wouldn't go as far as contemporaries in iPhones and that sort of thing, but it had a very contemporary feel about it. They were in not really suits, trousers and shirts, and it was quite a brutal production in terms of, it was guns rather than swords. There was nothing romantic about it at all, actually. It was all pretty brutalist. I guess when we moved to Greenwich, it just needed considerably more blood, effectively. we found that the rain machine that we had at the Tristan Bates did a quite effective job in 10, 20 seconds, whereas at the Greenwich, because it's possibly 10 times as large, you know, it needed considerably more blood to pump through.
Yeah.
And I think the... I think you've just got to listen to the space, and the space is, it's just not big enough. You need to widen this out. So actually, even in previews, we expanded the playing space, because we played with a voyeuristic element of the play, which was at the Tristan Bates. And then actually, when you move it into somewhere like the Greenwich, you it's not naturalistic, it's not voyeuristic, it has to be played out. So actually, we altered, there was quite a few asides that then went out that at the Tristan Bates didn't. We complete, so we got, Isabella had quite a few, so we sort of got part of the audience on side with her. Lancaster had a few, so there was, and Edward had a few. So there was, so we made more, I think, conscious decision of direct address, where in the Tristan Bates in a studio, an actor can flick their eyes out and get 40, 50 people, whereas in the Grinch, they'd have to turn out and make it a very deliberate effect, which might seem obvious, but actually, it certainly isn't. I don't think it is obvious. I think it's when you get into the space and you go, right, we're going to have to pull this thing out. It's a lot bigger. And the gesture, the ideas just have to be stronger and bolder and bigger, I think.
And I'd like to thank Ricky and Gavin for speaking to me and the Greenwich Theatre for giving us a space to chat in. Support your theatres. That's it for this week. If you live near Bath, go out and buy tickets to Dr. Faustus. If you're based in London, look at Lazarus and the next season in Greenwich next year. Website links are all in the data for this episode. Next week we'll be releasing something, probably a couple of things, but I don't quite know what yet. If you can support the work, then do pledge something today. That's www.patreon.com/beyondshakespeare. Woo.